Dr. Dan Siegel sees resistance as a disruption to the brain's natural tendency toward integration. So when Dan comes up against a client's reluctance, he instinctively looks for the hiccups in their neurobiological history. Here Dan shares two clients who developed deep patterns of resistance and how he helped them dislodge it.
In interpersonal neurobiology, we see that the mind is this self-organizing, emergent property that's both embodied and relational, and that regulates the flow of energy and information. And optimal self-organization comes from differentiating and linking. Now, in this view of the mind, each of us have a mind that's both within the whole body, not just the brain, and within our relationships. And I talk a lot about this next book, Mind, and I wrote a lot about in the Developing Mind book. But the issue here is that because we are, in this view, complex systems, there's a natural drive toward well-being. So reluctance or resistance is a block towards seeking a way to liberate this self-organizational move toward, which basically uses integration to optimize its flow. So from an interpersonal neurobiology point of view, the way we would approach your question, Ruth, about resistance is something like this. Each of us has an innate drive toward health. Our view is that health comes from integration, whether that's in your brain, and the connectome studies support that now, or studies of psychopathology. Everyone with a major psychiatric disorder has impaired integration of the brain that's been looked at so far, whether that's experientially induced or non-experientially induced. In my view, all forms of psychotherapy, and as I mentioned, interpersonal neurobiology is not a form of therapy, but it informs therapy. Our view is that the ones that have been shown to work, and maybe the others that work but just haven't been studied, because they can be just as effective, are promoting integration relationally and promoting integration neurologically. So when a person has, quote, resistance that they're reluctant to seek the help they need, our view is that there's some aspect of their system that is impeding the natural drive for differentiation and linkage. Now, you know, I'm trained as a biochemist, and so we always use this term called energy of activation. So when there's molecules, you know, that are hanging out and an enzyme is going to change their relationship with each other, you got to stick a certain amount of energy in, mess around with the order that's there, create a little disorder, and then settle into a different state that now has this increased energy. And I don't know if it's true or it's just my weird background as a biochemist, but, you know, I see resistance as meeting this energy of activation that takes a fixed system that's either fixed in rigidity or fixed even in chaos and saying, how do we introduce a certain energy pattern within that resistant system, in your terms, so that we can take this energy of activation and allow the person, and here is the one way of kind of responding to your question, why are people resistant? What do you do about it? Is that from structure, you need to have disorder in order to reorganize a complex system. And the energy of activation needed can be small, and someone says, give me a therapist that's good, I'm going to go tomorrow, right? Or someone says, no way, I'm not going. Or they say, I'm not going to do therapy, I'll do mindfulness. Yeah, that's cool, the mindfulness revolution, I'll do it. And I'll just give you an example of someone who had some resistance. And it's an important example because this was a teacher of a branch of meditation that ran a program and everything, but was having difficulty in his personal life. But publicly, he was revered as a someone could teach you, in this case, it was mindfulness meditation, a form of it. So he came for therapy at the reluctance of himself. He had resisted it forever, and now he was in his 50s. And he was ending his third marriage. And so I said, okay, well, thank you for coming, and I appreciate it. And he goes, okay. And I said, well, you know, what we try to do in therapy is find out how things are going, imagine what kind of things developmentally have brought you to this place, and then try to bring into view where you might like to go. He goes, all right, well, that makes sense. I said, so the first thing, you know, we're going to do is in the first couple of sessions is we're going to do something called the adult attachment interview. I'm a scientist, I say, so I use a science-based inventory that I'm trained in called the adult attachment interview, and it helps us get a picture of what your past was like. He goes, I don't do that. And I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, I've been spending my whole adult life developing the art of being in the present. This is what I teach people all the time. Don't you know that? Yes, I know that. So I don't go to the past. So I said, okay, well, so what if you imagine that the way neuroplasticity works is right now you have certain configurations in your whole body, including your brain, that are synaptic shadows of events that happened before but are present now. He goes, well, then why do I have to talk about the past? I said, well, part of it is that we have this research instrument that allows us in the present to explore your feelings and recollections in the present, see what arises in the present, and open yourself up. And you not doing this for all these decades, I mean, how's that been going for you? And he goes, well, I guess not so well. So I said, so, and here's, I guess, part of the answer to your question. And I don't even know how to put this to words, Ruth, but it goes something like this. Because it's not just him. There's so many people of different kinds of resistance. I'm giving his as an example because, you know, he's using what Jack Kornfield would call a spiritual bypass, trying to get into a spiritual practice without actually doing the work. And it wouldn't look on the surface like he's resistant, but he's massively resistant. I'm sitting with the person. I see myself as a node, a kind of bodily node in a larger system. And the other person in front of me has a body, and they're a node in a larger system. And in the system that we're going to create together, is the liberation of the innate drive toward integration. And the resistance to that is not being done necessarily on purpose. It's often out of fear or anxiety or terrible grief. And so I look beyond the wall of resistance and see into that person's eyes and see into their whole system the deep desire that, in my experience, has never been killed, has, no matter what the trauma may have been, that is longing to be freed. And I don't even know how to put words to this, but I just kind of feel like I can resonate with that aspect of the person. I have a quantum view of this, which I can share with you if you want, but where there's a plane of possibility of energy patterns that are not stuck in these, in our terms, plateaus and peaks of resistance. And I look to that plane of possibility and I speak to it indirectly, because someone who's resistant won't want to hear any of this stuff. And then what I do is I back off from pushing. So let's talk about Stuart, this 92, and in the case, by the way, of the meditation teacher, massive, massive trauma in his childhood. He never wanted to talk about. He became an expert in the present moment, so he didn't have to go to the past. I understand that, we can all understand it, but, you know, the mind doesn't work that way where you can ignore things. Liberation comes when you say, bring it on. So for him, it worked beautifully, and it was an incredibly painful journey, but an important one. For Stuart, you can read about that case. He's a 92-year-old who's incredibly resistant, and he says, basically, his family thought he was depressed. His wife had been taken ill and taken to the hospital. He came in. I didn't think he was depressed, but I did the adult attachment interview on him, and even as a litigating attorney, you know, he was feisty all the way, but he did it. Clearly had an avoidant attachment history as a child, that his wife affirmed that his parents were very disconnected, and he himself had what's called dismissing attachment. In any event, when you look at the probable neurobiology of that, it means that he hadn't developed much of his nonverbal, more right hemisphere dominant mode, and his left hemisphere is very, very resistant, if you will, to getting into the uncertainty and lack of control of his right hemisphere. So in Stuart's case, and you can see it step by step in the all the details of the case, his resistance was really strong. So my experience as a clinician, you know, doing this for so many decades, is when there's a lot of resistance, I actually back off. And in Stuart's case, you know, he said something like, you know, a partner of mine at the law firm is dying and I don't feel anything. And in fact, you know, people my whole life said, how do you feel? And I don't even know what that question means. So I kind of have a nonchalant attitude towards that. You know, obviously I'm really interested in that, but I nonchalant attitude. I said, okay, well, whatever. He goes, you know, don't you think I should know what that means? I go, but do you want to know what it means? He goes, well, maybe before I die, I'd like to know what that means. And it's not right, he says, that I've been with someone in my firm for over 50 years and they're dying and I feel nothing. There's something wrong about that. So I give him the overall view, which is, I said, you know, look, you're 92. It looks like you had a dismissing attachment as an adult, probably an avoidant attachment as a kid. It's not your fault, but probably half of your brain developed primarily, and it was great in law. I said, why would you want to change anything now? My gosh, you're 92, you've done fine. And he goes, don't you think you could help me? And I go, I don't know. I mean, do you really think you need help? He goes, yeah, I think I do, you know, like this. So by backing off, rather than shoving it at him, it gives him the space for his system to begin to reorganize where he can feel empowered to choose.
As Dan said, giving clients that space can be so important for the client's healing. Dan earlier brought up the idea of a spiritual bypass, where clients avoid the necessary work for healing. For some further insights on this, let's hear from Dr. Kelly McGonigal and Dr. Joan Borisenko.
Often in the compassion trainings that we do, one of the exercises I lead people in, there is an instrument called the Fears of Compassion Scale that was developed to help people who are trying to cultivate greater compassion or self-compassion. This comes from Paul Gilbert. And he has identified all of these really common deep-seated beliefs about why compassion for oneself or others can be dangerous or risky, or why you might be philosophically against compassion in certain circumstances. So the exercise I lead people in is I ask them to read the statements, to read them aloud, to try to connect to the feeling behind those statements. Like, there are some people in this world who just don't deserve compassion, or if I'm compassionate with myself, I fear that I will never be able to climb out of this pit of sadness. That's not the exact wording, but that's sort of the flavor of them. And then they, in small groups, they talk about the ones that they can resonate with, the fears that are still present for them in some way, or the obstacles or barriers, even though these are people who have chosen compassion. And usually, at least in one group, there'll be someone who says, I'm beyond all of this. I don't have any barriers to compassion. I have compassion for everyone. And they would rather argue with the fears than in a moment of vulnerability say, sometimes I do fear that if I'm too compassionate, people will take advantage of me or whatever. The way that I work with that, because often they're very loud about it too. You can hear them and they're working in their small groups and there's a very loud voice being like, no, I have no fears of compassion, is to ask questions like, well, that's really interesting. What would it mean if you did? So, you know, like, what's one in particular that you is really like, you definitely don't have? What would it mean if you did? And would it be okay if you ever felt that way? The way that Dan talked about trying to really connect to the pain and also the potential, and to try to shine that light of compassionate awareness. And not to go at it too hard, because when someone's right in the middle of that, it's just like any other kind of resistance. If you go at it, it's going to intensify, particularly if it's an identity threat. So that's how I work with it.
You know, if I may add, and I know we're going a little ways, you know how I often work with it is taking advantage of the role of being either the teacher or the therapist, which is often the role that I'm in, and taking advantage of getting older so that, you know, I've been at it for a while, self-disclosing a lot about all of my non-spiritual experiences, of which it's a limitless supply every hour. And so when the person tells me, you know, how advanced they are and how, oh yeah, narcissistic concerns, nah, they're way beyond that, or anger, no, they're way beyond that, I'll say, wow, how do you do it? Because for me, this happens all the time. And in fact, happened 10 minutes ago, it's happening right now as we discuss this, and I'll start doing this. And often, at very least, out of compassion, they wind up actually digging in to think of, oh yeah, maybe I can join him and not leave Ron hanging out here alone, looking like, you know, the only undeveloped person in the room. And then they'll start talking about their own stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully the whole point of that sort of exercise in public is usually most people are quite, quite able to do that. And then it becomes not just Ron, but also all of these other amazing, passionate
people. We're in this together, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's so important to have role models that that are include all of these different dimensions of experience.
You know, the idea of a spiritual bypass is, it's really common these days. And it comes up quite a bit. And I just want to talk about a client that I had and the way that we... I dealt with this, because you can also pathologize a spiritual bypass, and I think that's a mistake. So what we did, this was a woman who actually, her business was feng shui and hanging crystals, and she had, you know, made all this jewelry out of different kind of crystals that was meant to bring in certain energies and ward off other energies. And much like the example that Dan Siegel was talking about, she just thought you could deal with everything from an energetic point of view. But the problem was that her life really wasn't working very well in terms of relationships. And she just couldn't hang on to a relationship. And so the way we talked about this was to really look at all of the benefits that she had gotten for herself and given to other people through the spiritual work that she was doing, through the feng shui, what she'd learned about balancing of energies. And we thought, what a great kind of groundwork this was for her. And now that there was the groundwork, the question was, what were the things that we were just talking about now, maybe the unconscious things that might be blocking some of the energy that couldn't be seen? And then we started to talk about, well, what about the things from the past? Maybe you've put them out of your mind, and clearly you've done a great deal of healing on the energetic level. But just by discussing this, she was able to, as if it was her own idea, to get into some of the trauma from the past and begin to work with that, which is, of course, what really needed to happen. But first, giving her the sense of safety and the sense of affirmation from what she did was important, and certainly not to pathologize by referring to it as a spiritual bypass.
That's a useful perspective about the danger of pathologizing a client's spiritual bypass. In the next bonus, we'll look at how to approach resistance in relationships. I'll see you then.